Welcome to the Millionaire Next Door podcast with Robert Curtis, CFP, accredited investment fiduciary from Signature Estate and Investment Advisors. In this podcast, we help successful wealth accumulators like you looking to transition to a work optional lifestyle by helping you build strategies for growing and maintaining your wealth. Robert draws from years of experience and fiduciary responsibility and interviews guest experts to help you build reliable strategies to grow and maintain your wealth. Now, on to the show.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us again for another edition of the Millionaire Next Door podcast. We are so pleased to share guests that are of interest, and I just get so much great feedback. So let us know if you have ideas. Today, we have a guest. It's really interesting. His name is Mark Higgins. He's a CFA, Chartered Financial Analyst. He's a CFP. He was introduced to me, and he's written a book on financial history and the markets. So this has just come out. He shared with me, I guess it's had a pretty good launch. At one point, you were beating out a book by Tony Robbins, which sounds impressive. So, Mark, welcome. Tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll dive into today's podcast.
The origins of the book, it really started in March 2020, when I was an investment consultant. Really, it was advising foundations, endowments, and pension plans. And when COVID hit, it just kind of caught everybody off guard, including myself. I started reading financial history as a habit, which I had more time because everything was basically shut down. And the more I started reading about financial history, the more I started discovering, first of all, not only was what we were experiencing not really unprecedented, if you go back far enough, also that I was pretty shocked that using history was much more useful in advising clients and putting things into context. And then finally, I was kind of flabbergasted that nobody had written a complete book of the financial history of the United States. Now, there was a book in several, I think it's like 7 volumes or 3 volumes, I forget the actual number, but it's just not very accessible and more of a data dump of facts. There wasn't really a single resource out there. Not only did I think it was very useful for institutions, but also individuals, I couldn't believe that there wasn't one already. So that's what really inspired me to write it.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of repeating themes. We're kind of in this brave new world. But sometimes there's, no, this happened in this year. There was a similar type of phenomenon. Go a little deeper. Tell us some of the things you found or points you want to emphasize.
I have toward the back of the book some of the more important insights. But really, the way I structure the book, there's probably like maybe 50 of these kind of text boxes called points of interest, which teach critical financial and economic concepts in the context of when they were most important. Bringing it up a level, I think some of the big lessons are, first of all, the present is largely some sort of recombination of the past. And the COVID-19 crisis was a great example of that. If you were familiar with the Panic of July that happened in July 1914 at the onset of World War I, if you were familiar with the inflation that followed the last global pandemic, the Great Influenza, and World War I, you wouldn't have been surprised by what you saw during the post-COVID inflationary period that we're still in. And then lastly, if you were familiar with what happened in the late 1960s and the 1970s with the Fed tightening and then pulling back too soon, you could expect the Fed to be aggressive in response to the inflation once it proved to not be transitory. And that December sort of early tilt toward dovishness, it seemed highly probable that they would pull back. That is the value of studying financial history. You can see how the present recombines. That's kind of a long-winded answer. Another thing is just generally by supplementing your memory with the memories of your ancestors, and this is where it was helpful for institutions, it just makes the present events, both economic and financial, seem a lot less mysterious. You can narrow down the types of scenarios that are going to occur as a result and ultimately become a better financial decision maker.
Yeah, I think those are important. COVID, it was 100 years since the last massive pandemic. We never shut down before, but the massive expansion of the Fed balance sheet created horrific inflation. And now they're trying to get that under control. But it's pretty tough once you let that genie out of the bottle. So yeah, any others that, I think back in the day, I'd read something really interesting, how railroads, at the time in the late 1800s were sort of the internet or hot dots. They've carried through, but we're in such an interesting time now with AI and things like that. I had read that actually, I think it was Johnson, they were looking at AI back then. They were worried that it was going to take over all these jobs, and Martin Luther King Jr. had actually preached on it. They were aware of this thing. It just took a very long time for it to filter through. But yeah, so the things like that really pop out of interest when you see some parallels, but
Yeah,
keep
and
going.
that's something that you see a lot of the cycle, and it's usually longer than people think about in terms of investments. You have these long wait cycles. Now, I would argue like something like the dot-com and the AI craze reminds me a little of dot-com. That goes quicker. But the two things today that seem a little worrisome from a historical perspective are, but in more than the massive investment, just the everyone's claiming that they're using AI now. And it reminds me of the dot-com era when everyone was had their internet strategy. And the problem with these situations is you have a technology that is going to dramatically change our life potentially, but the number of companies claiming that they're going to profit from it often exceeds, and I think it already has here, often exceeds the value of what they're creating. That's what happened with the dot-com. I mean, Amazon was founded during the dot-com era. That was a real company that obviously grew to a tremendous valuation. But there are so many companies that were claiming similar things that disappeared. And you see this repeatedly throughout history. You saw it with railroads, where you would have periodic booms and then busts and massive bankruptcies, pretty much everything in the 1920s, late 1920s, that led to the crash. So with go-go stocks in the 60s, these and then dot-com stocks. So you see these things repeatedly. And it's not that it's all garbage. It's just that the number of people claiming that their valuation should be higher, essentially because of their use of AI, usually exceeds the actual benefits.
One that really caught my attention recently, obviously everyone's talking NVIDIA and it just keeps going and it's
Yes.
for real, but the valuation. And then I just happened to notice something the other day. There's an ETF, I forget the ticker. It's two times NVIDIA. That's what the ETF is. It's double NVIDIA. So that
Unbelievable.
really raised an eyebrow. We're very concerned. There's these double, triple type indexes. You're really. It did just trigger that you're really starting to gamble there. And
Yep.
our compliance department doesn't, for good reason, because most of our folks, but when I see this double NVIDIA, it's sort of kind of it definitely raised an eyebrow. You had a similar reaction, I could tell. And it's
Yeah,
sort of,
it's a red flag. And you see that the double and triple is even more concerning. But
yeah.
you saw that in the dot-com era where all of a sudden, I don't know the actual numbers, but call it 10 tech-focused
Yeah.
mutual funds. And then within a year or two, it was like 125 or something like that. I don't, roughly, that's directionally correct. I don't have the actual numbers. I do have it in the book. But yeah, it's the same dynamic. Risky funds popping up, and usually that's in the later phases.
Tell you one of the beauties that I've really learned as I've been doing this north of 26 years, and one of my prior podcast guests recently just commented on supply. I love the whole supply and demand concept, right? That you learn in Econ 101. That's pretty true to form. To me, that's almost like a physics kind of law, gravity and these things that are pretty immutable. When you do see these things go excessive on the upside or horrible, a lot of times they're a manifestation of overall supply and demand, which matter and I pay attention to. Sometimes they get really extreme, and we have that plotted through bell curves and standard deviations and stuff like that. But that's one constant we look at. You can look across times and then compare some of the metrics of where things were. But yeah, keep going with some of your thoughts and things you'd uncovered, in your book and the research.
Yeah, a couple other things that if I had to pick the most powerful insight that I didn't appreciate going into this, it's the changing, well, the changed perspective on the use of the public debt. So if you go back to the book starts with Alexander Hamilton in 1790, and the United States was a financial disaster. I mean, they're essentially defaulted on their debt. They didn't have enough revenue coming in to pay it down, and they lacked a central bank. And Alexander Hamilton fix those three things. One informal precedent that he set, and this is articulated in his first report on the public credit to Congress in 1790, he emphasized that the public getting a sterling rating for your debt or opinion on your debt was critical because you need it in times of emergency. And he mainly defined that in terms of war, foreign war specifically. Then after the emergency subsides, you pay it back. And we followed that policy for more than 150 years. When the War of 1812 came, we ran up the debt, paid it down. When the Civil War came, ran up a lot of debt, paid it down. World War I, same thing. And then after World War II, we were so exceptionally wealthy. We had the world's reserve currency, and we had the only intact industrial infrastructure that was not only intact, but it grew substantially because we were arming not only ourselves, but also our allies during the war. So we had this changed perspective on how much we can afford to spend as a government. And by the 1960s, we were spending beyond our means. The world was catching up, so we could no longer to afford to spend at that level, but we kept going. And for the past 60 years, we've not only been running deficits during times of emergency, but we've been doing it during non-emergent times. And that's a fundamental shift in the perspective on the use of the public debt over the past 234 years.
Yeah, and there's no question. I've seen it. It really became alarming. So obviously there was 2008, right? And then QE1 and QE2. And then especially with COVID, the stimulus, but the expansion of the balance sheet, you know, and the money supply. So of course that created inflation. And I'm not trying to make commentary, but it's, you can see it. And of course that created massive inflation. And even California, I think they were taxing all those relief payments, right? So they had a huge surplus. Now they're running a huge deficit that's run away. They're starting to bring it down, but I mean, in terms of they changed this massive upward trajectory, but there's still a ton of money flowing out there. And it's concerning, maybe not for the next 6 months or who knows, but it's really ballooning. And it is a big concern and a worry. And it's just something we factor into our model and process and want to make folks aware in a rational way of where does it make sense to allocate your funds. But there doesn't seem to be a ton of appetite to pull things back, given
Man,
the political
the
process. It's a giant problem. And
this
it's
a long-term
come to,
problem. And
they've come to where, you know, they stimulate for everything. So at least rates are up, so they have some room to cut. But my goodness, it is a big concern. We think about it a lot. We see it. And some of the economists I've followed see that as pretty unprecedented going to those
It is unprecedented.
Levels.
In U.S. history, it is unprecedented.
They're literally scratching their head. You know what I mean? And that was to look at
But the difference is not responding to emergencies. The difference is not running surpluses during non-emergencies. That is the difference. It's like,
Oh no. I mean, it's just something we have to live with, but we're becoming aware of it and we think it matters. And I would love for the public dialogue to shift on this. I think the last time we really, as I was heard a recent explanation, I think between Clinton and the first Bush, they actually did pay down a bunch and got to a good spot. But since
that
then,
was a kind of
just
an anomaly though. I mean, that was a little anomaly because it was,
they had a surplus.
Related.
Yeah. But keep going. We don't want to just riff or make a, but it's a fact. It's pretty hard to deny. And it's like your doctor, you can engage in risky behavior for so long, but at some point it's going to start to matter. And tipping point, and certainly with inflation, it was pretty dramatic. And we're not surprised. I don't have a PhD in economics, but it seemed pretty clear to connect those dots.
So. Yeah. And the same thing happened. And this is another point. I mean, I'm expanding a little on one of the value propositions of studying financial history, but I was actually just at an event last night. The Museum of American Finance holds an annual gala to honor people that have had some big accomplishments in the area of finance. And Howard Marks was one of the award recipients. And he just emphasized how much he reads on financial history and how it's just essential to understand what came before to really be a good investor. And that's almost like, I mean, COVID was obviously horrible, but it made an interesting case study of how financial history can really have practical value. And if I have a chart, which I know we don't have visuals here, but it just shows the multiple events that could help you understand what the Federal Reserve was likely to do, how the economy was likely to respond after COVID subsided. It actually wasn't that hard to forecast at a very high level how this was going to play out, because the same thing happened in 1918 and 1920, from 1918 really to 1921. And if you knew how the critical lessons of the Great Inflation, you knew that the Fed had to get aggressive and stay aggressive, because they don't want to ever repeat that mistake. And that's one of the biggest mistakes they've ever made, that and not saving the banking system in the 1930s. So there's a very practical element to understanding the the full financial history of the United States. Sometimes we assume that things were so much different back then, but they really weren't. People behave differently. There are different tools. There are different personalities, but at a high level, things don't change as much as people think. And by learning about the past, you can really make better decisions in the present.
There's no doubt. I mean, I know like Warren Buffett just reads extensively, right? He's a really great student and spends a huge amount of each day. I mean, I do the same. There's a lot of deep wisdom there. I mean, some things were different. COVID, I'm just thinking, I actually started the podcast right about then because people weren't coming in, and how we were able to pivot and work from home or wherever we needed to be. I think in LA County, they wouldn't let you into the office. So we had the systems, things like online delivery or the shift to more people working remote, these trends in office markets and people not going back. Some of those things were different. We were actually able to function and do the work, thank goodness. But it evolved our business quite a bit because we were able to travel and be remote. And I think you said you're in New York today. So here you are on a podcast. You don't need to be tethered to your home office or your office or whatnot. But yeah, I'm a huge fan of, looking at the history. What else would you like to comment on? We've hit on tight monetary policy. I know you wanted to maybe comment on making market efficiency an ally.
Big lesson was a big change that happened on Wall Street was in 1934 with the passage of the Securities Exchange Act. And prior to that, the markets, they're called stock operators, stock plungers sometimes, they had a different name. But the way they would make money is by manipulating the market and engaging in insider trading. I mean, that was kind of the routine. But then after the passage of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, that was outlawed, and securities analysis became really the only way to outmaneuver the market. But as markets became deeper and volume increased, the opportunity to find mispriced securities contracted. And Ben Graham, who was the icon for value investing by 1963, said that most people can't outsmart the market. It's just too hard. And now there are some people that can do it, but it's very rare and much more rare than people think. As you see that evolution, you can see why the focus became outperforming indexes that once we got more distance from the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. And I work with institutions, and I work for index fund advisors, so we recommend index funds. And it's actually especially helpful, in my opinion, with institutional investors, because not only is it hard to outperform using active managers or going into alternative investments, but they have instability of their own governance. So every 4 or 5 years, the trustees turn over and they can unwind the strategy of the previous trustees at the exact wrong time. So it's almost like a hedge against the governance instability that you see with institutions. And that's something I read a lot about in chapter 25 called Manufacturing Portfolio Complexity.
Right.
It's something that it's hard to notice because it goes kind of slow, but over the past 50 years, particularly in the institutional space, portfolios have gotten incrementally much more complex, and the expenses of a lot of the funds have gone up because you're going into alternative asset classes, and there's a lot of data now indicating that it's just not paying off.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time looking at the indices. I love the efficiency. When you talk about these inefficient, remember Trading Places, the movie, and that kind of thing. Or I just remember, even makes me sound like an ancient fossil, but when they went to decimalization, right, versus these fractions, how much of a spread there was. So things are much more efficient. But I dialogue quite a bit with clients on this, and the composition of indices, they're not all the same. They could be wildly different, whether it's QQQ, or we've seen what's called RSP, the S&P 500 equal weight, and that's broadened out. So these have implications. You could be in the semiconductor space in that index.
But when I'm talking about indexes, I'm talking about broad markets. I'm not talking about sector funds where you're indexing a specific sector. It's the broad U.S. market, broad international market. And there are different ways to do it. There's the cap weighted, and there's particularly with factors, the Fama French model, the value premium, the small cap premium, and profitability premium. There are factor-based indexes that there's a lot of evidence that they will outperform or expected to outperform in the future. But what I'm really talking about here is not making bets on sectors. It's making a bet on the entire U.S. economy, essentially.
And that's key. It's interesting you bring that up. Certain areas or sectors or certain businesses. In other words, I don't know that I want to own all 500 of those at times. Yet we'll have index exposure. So I look at like the Dow. I think they're kicking out Walgreens Boots Alliance, and what's coming in its place? I forget. Might be Amazon or something. Or
yeah, I'm not sure.
Correct me if I'm, but you know, that thing was a dog ever since it went in. So it's interesting how these indexes morph and stuff too, and change over time and things that move out of them. But it's a fascinating area, and there's actually quite a bit to it, right? It's not as simple as just pick one and the lowest cost. One of the beauties is the transparency inside of an index. So you can see what's in there, yeah. Right? So a lot of these things, now a lot of stuff's going to be driven by NVIDIA. What's their allocation? And one index is going to look much better if it has a higher allocation. There's another one, SMCI. It's a microcomputer. That thing is driven like this huge outperformance of the Russell 2000 in a gigantic way. So how they're comprised could be really different. It's just good to know what you own.
Yeah, those to me are short-term. Of course, if you're in the right place during a tech boom, you're going to outperform a broader index. Yep. Yep. Long term, what we recommend is broad indexes. Now, we do use factor-based indexes as well as cap-weighted, but it's really broad. It's not, we don't make bets on sectors.
No, I understand. I'm careful in that space too. One that's really stood out, or maybe factor-wise, is momentum, which I think is a great factor. It was so out of favor for the last year, maybe year and a half, so extreme, but it's come back in such a giant way in a short time. And that really stood out. It's a pretty good factor. It was just out of favor. So sometimes these things are out of favor, but it doesn't mean their process is broken. So these are a lot of subtle nuances we pay attention to. And you want to take the big picture, but you also want to look at some of the noise and what's going on. And
Yeah. I mean, another thing that's come up, and this is really applicable for institutions, is the alternative assets, the increasing allocation to alternative asset classes.
Yeah.
And that is really concerning because you can't index them. So, I mean, you can't index buyout funds and venture capital. And I mean, I guess there are technically some indexes for that replicate hedge fund like strategies, but for the most part, these are private assets that you can't replicate. And with an index. And the problem with these areas is that if you don't have the required skill, discipline, and resilience to invest in these areas, you have to have that first. And a lot of pension plans and endowments and foundations, this sort of happened after David Swensen released this book in 2000, where he detailed the Yale strategy, which is people misinterpreted. They thought just going into alternative assets without any of the infrastructure required to succeed at it was all you need to do to replicate Yale. And people are getting very disappointing returns, and it's increasing fees. And so that is something that's kind of like a 20, 30 year trend at this point. The numbers that are coming out are just a simple 60, 40 portfolio is beating a lot of these strategies. So that's probably the bigger concern with institutions, is getting into areas of the market where it requires a lot of skill and durable skill that can last. That most of these funds are perpetuities, and they don't have that. And as a result, they're not going to pick the best funds. At best, they'll pick maybe the average funds, and there's a risk they're going to pick below average funds. And I think it's a risk that most trustees don't appreciate.
No, I get that. We do use some alternative funds, and we have a pretty robust platform. And I hear what you're saying. But we do a lot of diligence at a very high level with CFAs and a whole investment committee that we could spend a year and a half really understanding these. So we guide people through that. If they're left unattended and they're just trying to buy these, they really don't have any understanding of the nuances. So I hear everything you're saying. Sometimes with appropriately done, they've been a very safe bridge, or safer bridge, I should say, especially given some of these things going on, like the rising debt, the change in interest rates. We can make them a little bit more like the Yale model. These are analyzed by people who understand and have worked with an endowments, and you work with them too. Mm-hmm. You can guide them through if it's appropriate or not. And then if it is you know, that's a discussion we'll have. But I hear what you're saying. They're not going to be as efficient as a huge index like SPY or something like that.
We have chosen not to use them.
Yeah, I get you. There's more. Yeah, there's more to that. But it's kind of like having a really broad toolbox, right?
Yeah.
You could have whatever, 10 things that are going to cover almost everything you have around the house, but there might be some other things for other needs or situations that come up. So kind of running up against some time where it's a good time to kind of wrap up. But do you have any other points or things you want to mention that have come up?
To close it out, I started this process almost 4 years ago to the day. I don't know exactly what day I started on, to be honest with you, but it was in March sometime in 2020. I kind of went into this. I mean, it was a pretty tumultuous time. I went into it pretty pessimistic about what's going to happen to the United States. But as I worked my way from 1790 all the way to today, I started to realize that we do have problems. We have very real problems, and it's not going to be easy to solve them. But every generation thinks the whole world's going to fall apart after they, after they depart. And going back, if you look at the 1840s, 1860s, 1930s, things that actually looked a lot more dire than they do now. And that's, again, that's not to say we don't have problems. We do. But it gave me a lot more faith in the resilience of the United States. I think our economy, I think our financial system, our government is more stable than people often assume. That is not to dismiss the challenges, but I went into this pretty pessimistic about the future of the United States. I mean, not horribly pessimistic, but things looked a little dark in March 2020, but I emerged pretty confident. The United States has a lot of special things going for it in terms of the infrastructure that we have, the natural resources that we have, and most of all, just the spirit of innovation and the free markets that we have to leverage that. It's pretty unique, and I think it remains durable.
That's a really, really good point. And yeah, I have these concerns too, but in other ways, it is a really special place. And even Buffett himself said it's a really bad idea to bet on the American economy.
That's in the last paragraph of the book, that quote.
Oh, wow. Okay. So we're on the same page. And, you know,
yes.
I mean, just things, you know, even like Silicon Valley and the technology, really the world cannot match what's going on there yet.
Yeah.
And people come from all over the world, and it's these innovations and NVIDIA and Microsoft, and there's still these global leaders. So that's pretty giant, just the spirit of it. You know, it's really even COVID. It was nowhere like, I mean, the Spanish in terms of how you just had pollution in the streets. I mean, I look at everybody's worried environmentally. I've seen charts, you know, CO2 is coming down. We're emitting a lot less. I mean, the percentage of the world's population living in poverty is dropping. There's still way too many people in it, but it's a whole lot lower than it was. And just a number of things that, I mean, we have a huge, just the Great Lakes. It's a huge percentage of the world's fresh water. It's just absolutely shocking. So there really is a lot of positive. And a more recent level, just all the people calling for recession, the market was going to do that, right? It hasn't happened. So it's been pretty resilient. We're watching all that, but I share your comments. Your book, tell us the title of the book, and we'll post that in the show notes too. And tell us real quick how it's doing.
The title is Investing in U.S. Financial History. And if I had to do a short pitch for why it's valuable to read this book, I have found through this process that supplementing your own personal experience and memories with those of your ancestors is, at least in my experience, the most undervalued thing you can do as an investor. That it just gives you the context to be calm when markets look like they're going to go off a cliff and just make better investment decisions. And that's what I tried to do, is take all the wisdom from our ancestors that I could find.
Yeah.
And stuff it into a narrative so I can share that with people.
That sounds so helpful and so valuable. And I encourage folks to check it out. I just have to put one really nerdy comment that I think of this thing, epigenetics. I mean, it has nothing to do with, but you know how all this ancestral history is kind of baked into our genes, and they've only learned this in the last however many years that things had happened so it kind of made me think of a little parallel there, and it's supposed to help you. Sometimes it may hurt you, but some of that information is literally passed across generations, even though it's hard to fathom.
And it's a shame to lose it. You know, there's
it's
so
a
much.
shame, but nature's put a way to transmit that.
Yep.
It may not apply to the current circumstance, but I love that you've written it, that you've done the research. It's always interesting when you get into an area and you assume it's been covered, but it hadn't. Yeah.
And important point, all of this was covered. It's just in different places.
Yeah.
So
you
that was
consolidated
my
it.
frustration, is I had to read 200 books to figure out. I mean, I'm not joking. That's roughly,
Yeah.
I don't know what the number is because I lost track, but I estimated around there. But so there's great information out there. There was just no one source to really serve as a guide to people. And the book's going to be used as a textbook at, I'm also in New York to go to the first class for the spring semester for business school students. And it's going to be used as a textbook. And that's the reason why they have a course on financial history, but they were using so many different books. And it was just kind of hard. And this consolidates it all. So it's being used as a textbook. So it has academic applications as well as just personal and professional investing applications.
That sounds fantastic. And then getting a bunch of the new younger minds that are going into this area to understand some of these things from the past and helping them through that. It's got to be.
Yep.
And all that 200 probably got you through the pandemic, but you learned a ton. And
oh my gosh.
It
was the best educational experience I ever had in my life by far.
That's wonderful. Wow. Well, thanks for being on, Mark. Thanks for sharing. We'll put a link in the show notes to it. Let's stay in touch and love to hear how it goes in the future, and really appreciate folks tuning in and listening. And we'll be back next episode. So I hope you can join us.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Robert. It was a pleasure to join you today.
My pleasure. Great to have you. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Millionaire Next Door podcast. Click the subscribe button below to be notified when new episodes become available.
The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Signature Estate and Investment Advisors. Signature Estate and Investment Advisors, LLC, SEIA, is an SEC-registered investment advisor. However, such registration does not imply a certain level of skill or training, and no inference to the contrary should be made. Securities offered through Signature Estate Securities LLC, member FINRA SIPC. Investment advisory services offered through SEIA LLC, 2121 Avenue of the Stars, Suite 1600, Los Angeles, California, 90067. Telephone number 310-712-2323.